You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, August 1st, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, having trouble reading this, sorry. Bear with me. Here we go. David Gelis, climate reporter for the New York Times, author of The Man Who Broke Capitalism: How Jack Welch Gutted the Heartland and Crushed the Soul of Corporate America, and How to Undo His Legacy. Also on the program today, primary votes tomorrow: Arizona, Kansas, Michigan, Missouri, Washington State. Meanwhile, big vote in Kansas tomorrow on amending the Constitution to eliminate abortion rights. If you're in Kansas, you might want to involve yourself with that referendum. Meanwhile, in Kentucky, devastating floods leave 30 dead so far and counting, including four children. In D.C., the Senate voting on the PACT Act again today, as Republicans whine that their plan to punish Democrats backfired. Meanwhile, in the House, they passed the assault weapon ban. No word as to whether it'll even make the Senate. New poll showed Democrat likely voters have doubled in the wake of overturning Roe v. Wade. It's an outlier, maybe, but still. Speaking of still, Nancy Pelosi still planning to visit Taiwan, despite the fact that no one seems to think it's a very good idea. Bank of America memo shows the actual point of the Fed's interest rate rising. Raises. Roses. Governor DeSantis in Florida files a legislative complaint versus a restaurant that had a drag show, and kids were there. And lastly, Brendan Straka, the lib-turned-Trump supporter, walks away from charges as he dishes on his insurrectionist buddies. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Beginning of a new week. And joining me, as always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello. You could say that Brandon walked away from his friends, too, right?
Yeah, you could say a lot of those things. We do have to be careful of just because I don't want any litigation in terms of what we'll be getting. Be very specific.
Okay.
But we don't know that he actually physically walked away from anybody, but he did avoid getting charges by providing, I guess, a significant amount of information, at least from the perspective of the prosecutors. Now, he was upset about that information being released, of course, because, well, this is only speculation on our part. You can never really know what's inside the heart or the mind of a person. But I'm trying to put myself in his shoes, which is a little bit difficult. My shoes are not walking away, as it were. But I would imagine that if I was running a business pretending to be, let's say, a MAGA superstar, that it would inhibit my business to have it revealed that I threw all those people under the bus as fast as I could.
Yeah.
As fast as my walking shoes could take
exactly.
me.
Well, right. On the other hand, Brandon Straka would say, there is, and this is in all caps, nothing wrong, that's the end of the all caps, with talking to the DOJ and telling them your friends are innocent. So there you go, Sam.
That's right.
I'm sure that's what happened.
Well, of course. Prosecutors always, if you can come to them and tell them how innocent your friends are,
that's really helpful.
They will be like, oh, well, we really appreciate
that. You're a loyal
that.
Friend. Here's
and
a cookie.
Here's a cookie, and you can use this cookie as a way of having us drop charges against you. Because that's one thing that prosecutors really like. If you're a stand-up
yeah.
guy.
Yeah,
and
you're not a snitch.
It's like
talk
a guess
well
who.
About your friends.
When you play Guess Who, if you know who's innocent, you just put those down right away, and then only the guilty people are remaining. So
that's yeah. true. They could figure out all the other people must be guilty because all the ones he pointed out were not guilty. And then apparently he also sort of listed, well, I don't know if this is true, but one can imagine that he listed all of their like attributes in terms of like, oh, Billy plays guitar very well, and Jenny's not only really good with a flagpole,
great chocolate chip cookies,
spinning, yeah, and she can really draw,
and Betty really is great at tying knots.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and Kevin, you can't believe he'll take zip ties and make all sorts of like
it's
little
like origami.
Animals.
Yeah.
Like balloon animals, yeah.
Zip tie origami.
But maybe we'll talk more about that later. We just got into that. They couldn't help ourselves. And we will we have some images of what's going on in Kentucky. Really just brutal there. But first let's start here. Today in the Senate, Chuck Schumer said he's going to bring up the PACT Act again. This is the bill that would provide for veterans health care for those who have been exposed in theater or even in on their bases to toxic chemicals of one form or another and need extra health care because of it. The Republicans voted for this a couple of weeks ago. There had to be a technical fix for it, and no one anticipated that the Republicans would vote against it. In fact, I think there was a lot of veterans who were on the Hill to celebrate that it was going to be passed, and the Republicans were mad that Joe Manchin and Chuck Schumer had struck a deal on reconciliation, so they decided to punish the Democrats. It's really honestly like one of those things of like, you think I'm crazy? I'll show you who's crazy. And then shooting yourself in the face. And here they're on a tour now to make it seem like it's not their fault. The Democrats made them vote against the bill that they had voted for before. In fact, they did a tour. Here is,
like you said last week, this is Republicans acting like Democrats typically act.
Exactly.
Like complaining.
Complaining about like the most like ridiculous technicality that everybody's just sort of like, what? Maybe yeah. you should just shut your mouths.
Hiding behind Senate procedure. Democrats are great at that. And usually they're not in positions where their leadership has gotten won over on Republican leadership, which is the case here.
Indeed. Here's Bill Cassidy on ABC's This Week with John Carl.
All right, and quickly, before you go, I've got to ask you about this bill to help veterans who were had toxic exposure fighting wars on behalf of our country. You voted for this burn pit bill just a month ago, and now you voted against it this week. Can you explain why? Why did you change on this?
Yeah, so the bill will pass. I strongly support it. We have to stand by our veterans who have been exposed to these chemicals. There was a drafting error, a $400 billion drafting error that Democrats promised Republicans would get a vote on an amendment to fix. They denied us that vote. So what we're asking is give us the vote on the amendment. Let us try and go after a $400 billion drafting error. By the way, more than Manchin claims that this bill will reduce the deficit by, so that we can fix that and then move on to helping our veterans.
But to be clear, you did vote for it in its current form.
Yes, and I'll vote for its final passage, too.
Okay, all right. Senator Casting,
and
we
I'll
appreciate
vote for its final passage.
We appreciate your time. Yeah. Coming up.
Well, you know what might have been a great follow-up to that? So why did you do this?
It was odd that he left that question for the final section of the interview, so he couldn't really follow up.
I mean,
or you could have too.
Yeah, odd, very odd. But Republicans will take an L on that, as it were. All right. We will get in just a moment to David Gelis. He's the climate reporter for The New York Times, author of The Man Who Broke Capitalism, How Jack Welch Gutted the Heartland and Crushed the Soul of Corporate America. But first, a couple of words from our sponsors. The hot summer months are here, and you got to stay hydrated. One stick of liquid IV in 16 ounces of water hydrates you two times faster and more efficiently than water alone. Plus, liquid IV products taste great with 10 refreshing flavors that really sound like summer, from lemon lime to Concord grape to tropical punch, or what I am having today, watermelon. Yep, I know. I got off my tangerine kick and I moved into the watermelon flavor just because.
Wow.
Yep. Liquid IV contains five essential vitamins, B3, B5, B6, B12, and vitamin C. And with Liquid IV, you get three times the electrolytes of traditional sports drinks. Liquid IV is made with premium ingredients, no GMO, free of gluten, free of dairy, free of soy. The science of cellular transport technology is what makes Liquid IV so effective. It's designed to enhance rapid absorption of water and other key ingredients into the bloodstream. And Liquid IV is on a mission to change the world. The company's donated over 24 million servings globally. Folks, we're all big Liquid IV drinkers around here. You know that. You've been listening to the show. Every day I do one of these, at least. Sometimes I do two, depending on what's going on with the show. But it being that hydrated, it's obviously convenient for me because it's right over the course of these 3 hours or the 3 hours I'm prepping too. But it really does. I really do feel like it's impacted my health in some way.
I definitely feel a difference when I drink it, for sure.
You can grab your Liquid IV in bulk nationwide at Costco. Also, it's super easy to carry with you if you're traveling.
Yeah.
Put a couple of packets, their individual packets, into your bag and you fly or wherever it is. Take it to the beach. Grab your Liquid IV in bulk nationwide at Costco, or you can get 15% off when you go to liquidiv.com. Use the code MAJORITYREP. The code is MAJORITYREP. At checkout. That's 15% off anything you order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code MAJORITYREP at liquidiv.com. Also, leaving your house, leaving your office, always a huge pain, particularly in this like hot and humid and sweaty days. It's like 90 degrees in this city for like 2 weeks straight, maybe 3 weeks it felt like. Well, now you don't have to go at least to the post office. Why is that? Because Stamps.com is your 24/7 post office that you can access from anywhere, so you can skip the headache with Stamps.com. For more than 20 years, Stamps.com has been indispensable for over 1 million businesses. With Stamps.com, you get discounts you can't find anywhere else. They give you 30% off of USPS postal rates. That's U.S. Postal Service rates. And 86% off of UPS. Stamps.com seamlessly works with Shopify, Amazon, Etsy, eBay, and more. Oh, I should get Myla to do this with her Depop stuff. She pays so much on fees to that store for their shipping labels. And by she pays, I mean I pay.
You pay.
it just occurred to me, wait a second, I could be saving millions. Well, not quite more, but it feels like it. And the thing is, all you need is your regular computer and your printer. You don't need any special supplies or any special equipment. So even your kid who is reluctant to use it because they like the fact that they can just dish it off on their dad will be able to use it in just minutes. You can print official postage for any letter, any package, anywhere, and frankly, any time. 3 a.m, 2 a.m, 7 a.m, 10 at night, and you can send it anywhere. Don't mail and ship the hard way. Sign up with Stamps.com today. Sign up with promo code MAJORITYREPORT for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click the microphone at the top of the page, enter the code MAJORITYREPORT. And lastly, if you're a business owner, the last thing you want to do this summer is sort through tons of unqualified candidates' resumes when you could be redoing your deck or relaxing in the pool. or just doing anything, I guess, for that matter. That's why you need ZipRecruiter to find great candidates. They do the work for you, and now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter uses its powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job. You can easily review these recommended candidates and invite your top choices to apply. Additionally, ZipRecruiter has a complete suite of tools that makes it easy to filter, review, and rate your candidates. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. I've used this myself. It was actually like an incredibly easy and efficient process. Their user interface and organizing all the resumes, really helpful. You can rate them. You can queue them up for possible interviews. And I will tell you this, the best time to do it, folks, is when you don't need to hire. That way you've got a pool of potential candidates that you've developed. You go back in and check it out. You can soak up all the summer has to offer and let ZipRecruiter do the work. You ready for the URL? It's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's where you can try it for free. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, it's the smartest way to hire. And as always, we will put all the links to those offers at in the podcast and YouTube descriptions and on the website. Also, and just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can help this show survive and thrive by becoming a member. And when you do, you get the free show, free of commercials, and the fun half. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, David Gelles, he's a climate reporter for the New York Times, author of The Man Who Broke Capitalism, How Jack Welch Gutted the Heartland and Crushed the Soul of Corporate America. We'll be right back. We are back, Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland, and joining us, David Gelles. He is the climate reporter for the New York Times, author of The Man Who Broke Capitalism, How Jack Welch Gutted the Heartland and Crushed the Soul of Corporate America, and How to Undo His Legacy. Welcome, David. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, why Jack Welch?
Two reasons, two things led me to write this book. The first was that before I joined the Climate Desk, I wrote the corner office column for the New York Times. And during the last 5 years, I interviewed hundreds and hundreds of CEOs. And during all those interviews, one name kept coming up, and it was Jack Welch. And that just bugged me, right? That was like, why is this guy who retired 2 decades ago living rent-free in the minds of these CEOs today? And so that bugged me. Then I came across a story that brought it all home. I was one of the two reporters at the New York Times that covered the Boeing crashes and the aftermath. And when we dug into Boeing, we started to understand that, yes, there was an engineering story that explained tragically why 2 737 MAX crashed in a matter of 5 months, but that there was this deeper cultural story, that something had happened to Boeing over the past 25 years. And when we started unpacking that story, it was also the story of Jack Welch. Three of his protégés had explicitly transformed Boeing to be a company that resembled Jack Welch's GE. And when I started going from there, I started finding his fingerprints all over today's economy. And when I started thinking about the inequality we face, the problems we have in our politics, in our society, so many of them went back to the moves he made as CEO of General Electric from 1981 to 2001.
And just to remind people about the Boeing, and if I remember correctly, because this is this is really relevant, it seems to me, is that they did not want to invest when there was a change in airports. They did not want to invest in completely reorienting where their engines were on their planes because of the new walkways or something in the airports, if I remember correctly. And so instead, they tried to do like a software engineering sort of trick to it that made pilot error, I guess, or the software error that much more likely. But it was really just a way of avoiding long-term investment.
Boeing started nickel and diming its engineers in the early 2000s, right after the first of these Jack Welch proteges took over. And Boeing was transformed from a company that was renowned for its pristine, perfect aeronautical engineering. Pilots would say, if it's not Boeing, I'm not going. They wouldn't fly other planes because you knew that Boeing planes were designed the best and built the best. And then they started nickel and diming these places. And you can see it in, as you said, some of the decisions they made around engineering. And you can see it in things like outsourcing. Boeing used to make something like 66% of the components on its airplanes. Under one of these Jack Welch proteges, that ratio flipped. And all of a sudden, they were outsourcing 66% of the parts. And the list goes on in the ways that Boeing was transformed by the Jack Welch playbook.
All right, let's go back. Just you do a little bit of history of GE. This is a company that's now, I guess, 140 years old, almost 130 years old. Thomas Edison founded it. At one point, there was something that they practiced called welfare capitalism. What was that, and who came up with that term?
Well, that what we're referring to there is really sort of the ethos that corporate America and companies well beyond GE embraced during much of the 20th century. You know, there, of course, was the Gilded Age. But after that, after the Depression, and really from the middle of the 20th century right up until the 80s when Jack Welch came on the scene, there was this sense, and I know it's like foreign language to us, among CEOs and among corporations, that it was incumbent upon them to take good care of their workers, that it was a good thing to do things like pay the government your taxes, that they wanted to make an effort to pay their suppliers a good fare for the goods and services they were receiving. There was this sense that we were actually in it together. And that was reflected in phrases like welfare capitalism, which was a good thing in the minds of CEOs back then. And it was reflected in what was broadly known as the golden age of capitalism, where the wealth being created by corporations was actually widely distributed. They were paying their workers well. They were paying their taxes. They were trying to support other businesses because they understood that when everyone shares in the wealth, the whole country, the whole of society gets stronger. That obviously is not the world we live in today.
And we should also, you know, we got to be careful to put an asterisk there, because in terms of like sharing that wealth, I mean, it is known as the Great Compression, that era where we had a flattening of things like wealth inequality. But there were huge segments of our population who were not allowed to participate in the same way, of course. You know, largely Black people and other folks of color.
And I note that in the book without question. I don't want to oversimplify.
This of is course,
not, a, this is not Pollyannish here.
All right. So, one other thing happened in the early 80s, which was the Reagan Revolution, and this was the ascendance of. Milton Friedman is been on the scene for quite a while. He was sent down to help Pinochet create a free market, heaven there. So, I mean, is Jack Welch indicative of, like, I mean, he feels like he may have pioneered some of these things, but none of what he could have done. Could he have done in a different era? It seems to me. Is that accurate?
I think there's truth to that. The argument I make is that Friedman and people like Friedrich Hayek, they laid the intellectual groundwork for this Welch Revolution. And recall, Milton Friedman famously wrote in the New York Times Magazine in 1971, a full 10 years before Jack Welch became CEO, that the social responsibility of business is to increase its profits. But no one acted upon it until Welch came along. No one had the combination of the, you know, the gumption to actually do it, the platform of a company like General Electric, which is widely admired as the most respected company in corporate America, and the power of, you know, a company that at one point represented a full percentage point of GDP. And it was only when Welch got to GE and started implementing some of these things that had sort of been in the zeitgeist, but essentially unrealized for so long, that so much of the rest of the economy started to go along. And yes, the Reagan Revolution was happening at the same time, and Reaganomics was an enabler. You know, President Reagan, it was under his leadership, his SEC essentially changed the rule around buybacks in 1984, 85, was it, that unleashed this gusher of companies being able to legally manipulate their own stock. And who was the first CEO to launch a major share buyback program? It was GE. Jack Welch in 1986 or 87, right when that law is struck, $10 billion straight to buybacks. No more to the workers, no more to the suppliers. Forget the government. We're buying back our own stock in an effort to drive up our share price.
There was also a massive change in the way that we looked at antitrust during that time as well, where the Reagan administration adopted sort of the Borkian version of this. And Jack Welch, there was a figure that was astonishing that in terms of how many companies he bought and sold, like on a monthly basis.
1,000 deals during the time of his tenure. That's a major merger and acquisition every single week for 20 years. And of course, he did that in an effort to just boost the bottom line. He explicitly wanted GE to be the biggest, the most valuable company in the world. He knew he couldn't do that through organic growth. So he did it through inorganic growth, buying up companies far afield from its historical industrial roots and taking the company into areas like finance, and media, which were, of course, much more subject to all sorts of dangerous headwinds that would come back to bite the company later, and, of course, undermine GE's longstanding tradition of quality engineering and great relations with its workers.
And let's be clear, too, on what he would do when he would buy these companies, because this is really a story of extraction, it seems to me. He buys a company, he basically sells off or eliminates or fires all of those divisions of the company that aren't explicitly the one that is either making money or is somehow going to allow him to make more money so that he can vertically integrate it with existing companies that he has in the portfolio. So all you're doing is essentially you're extracting value out of these things, and you're not really building anything, are you?
He wasn't a builder, right? He wasn't an inventor. And if you look at the record of innovation at GE during his tenure, there's precious little to point to. You know, the one real innovation that came out of GE in the 20 years he was there was CNBC, you know, ESPN for the stock market. There was very little emphasis placed on creating new things of value. Instead, it was much more a strategy of looking to do what one exec in the book described to me as the Pac-Man model. Just go and gobble up other companies. And as you said, absolutely, spit out and fire workers that are deemed not essential. He would say, fix it, close it, or sell it. And he also said, I want to be number one or number two in every industry we're in, which again speaks to that absolute lust for consolidation.
Talk about the system of, I don't know what you would call this, management, I guess, that the people refer to as rank and yank. And I'm also curious about Sigma Six, how that functions. You can see sort of like some of that in 30 Rock. They do sort of parody some of that there. But I've had, some dealings over the years back in my entertainment days with some of those entities, and it was strange. We'll talk about both those systems.
Well, the first one that you mentioned is rank and yank. It was called stack ranking, rank and yank. He Jack Welch euphemistically liked the term the vitality curve, which makes it sound like so virtuous and healthful. But in fact, what he's saying is, if you're a manager at my company, you have to sort your employees into three groups, A, B, and C players. A players are the top 20%. B players are that fat 70 middle, the mediocrity. And the bottom 10%, those C players, the people you deem the worst at their jobs, they have to be fired every single year. So it didn't matter how good the company was doing. It didn't matter if actually there were no C players in a really, really humming division. You had to identify people and fire them. And what that did was absolutely erode the culture. It ruptured this longstanding belief amongst people who did get hired by companies like GE or IBM or Procter & Gamble that they had a pretty something close to a good job, one that they could count on until retirement, as long as they didn't totally screw up. And what it also did is make employees fight with one another. Someone was going to have to be in that bottom 10%. So instead of collaborating, instead of being cooperating, they started turning against each other, and it absolutely destroyed GE's culture. Six Sigma, which you mentioned, was another thing that in theory was designed to improve efficiency, but so often absolutely eroded culture, especially cultures of creativity and innovation, by trying to systematize and manage everything to the nth degree, leaving almost no room for real human connection, real human empathy.
Will you explain what that was? What that...
Six Sigma. Yeah, I mean, it is a very arcane management practice, which is designed to root out all errors and defects and any variability within a manufacturing process. And it was designed from inspired by the Japanese system, similarly known as Kaizen. And this is sort of the management consultant version of that for corporate America. And it involved a heck of a lot of sort of very arcane terms. But again, it was designed to systematize and formalize every single process. And when that actually made its way down, especially, as you said, to people who were doing creative work, who were doing supposed to be researching and designing and innovating, it absolutely stifled their creativity.
It wasn't there something like where they would take somebody who was working on ball bearings and then put them in charge of like production at CNBC or something like that?
I'm not aware of that specific example, but it doesn't sound too far-fetched.
Let's talk about the financialization of because again, you know, so much of this tracks like it feels like this was there were larger structural things happening that allowed for all of these moves that Jack Welch he saw these opportunities quicker maybe than anyone else, but they were structural. It was designed so that there would be a lot of Jack Welch's doing this. It seems to me the system, and particularly when we saw like the level of financialization, right? Like that was not. The company became less about building or making things than it did about like just financializing things.
This wasn't the weather that was just happening. This was his plan all along. Even before he became CEO, he was in charge of this little unit called GE Capital, and he understood the potential there. And in his memoir, he says something like, you know, I was amazed when I got a hold of the finance division because after spending so long trying to bend metal, I realized how easy it was to make money with money. And all of a sudden, sort of a light bulb goes off in his head, and he understands that he can make GE effectively an unregulated bank. So you see under Welch, GE, which made light bulbs and jet engines and power plants, pushing into things like high interest credit cards, commercial real estate loans, leasing operations. And ultimately, this unit, GE Capital, gets into things like subprime mortgages in 2005. Admittedly, it's after he retires, but it was part of the strategy that he had set in place and that his successor continued. They're chasing any little sliver of profit where they can find it, and it gets them into subprime mortgages, which I don't think we have to stretch to agree is about as far away from GE's industrial businesses, the things that actually sort of brought America into the modern age 100 years ago, as you could possibly imagine.
But when you're making money with money, right, then you don't necessarily need to deal with pesky workers. I mean, how much is union busting integral to this strategy?
So Welch pulled off this amazing feat. On the one hand, it has to be acknowledged. He never went to war with the unions. He never faced a national labor strike when he was CEO of GE in 20 years. Now, his predecessors couldn't say the same thing. GE had up and down relations with its labor unions over the years. What he did, though, was find ways to systematically decrease the amount of union representation. And he did it with things like outsourcing and offshoring. He would just simply give the unionized parts of the business less money. And he did it all the while being very explicit that he didn't want union labor. And this was something, a campaign that he continued well after he retired, going on panel discussions, and debating with Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel economist, talking about, you know, the ways in which, in his words, unionized labor was detrimental to successful industries, which, of course, just flies in the face of American history.
Its role in manufacturing weapons. How big of an arms manufacturer was GE?
I honestly don't know the entire answer to that question. So I'm not going to get up here and try to give a number I don't understand. Boeing, obviously, which is a company that I looked at closely, has a very big arms business. GE, I think, has played a role in the defense industry, but as I understand it, it's not a huge one.
Let's talk about the ownership of NBC and its involvement in the news. You touch on his potential like stories, anecdotes of his interference. I have a couple of my own back in the day in the early aughts. I knew people who worked there, and I would hear stories of him calling down back when Frank Luntz was on air, and him calling down and having problems with Donahue when Donahue got off the air. And that ran through. I mean, you talk about the election. How much of that was going on? And why else would you buy that if you are a GE? Why else would you own a media enterprise, if not because you have ancillary interests that are associated with that?
I think there are a bunch of reasons why GE bought RCA, which was the parent company of NBC at the time of the merger in 86 or 87 it was. They had a big TV set business that they wanted to merge with, and that actually became a big TV set business, fulfilling his number one, two, or three mandate. It was an advertising business, and he was keen to diversify away from manufacturing and get into things like advertising. NBC, he understood, was a potential host of the Olympics on television, and he liked that. Welch was sort of like absolutely liked the limelight and bid on the Olympics in part to entertain his friends and stars. And yes, you know, in time, I think he realized that he had the potential to influence coverage. Now, I cite a few examples of that. I've heard of a couple others. I don't get the sense that he was quite meddling in coverage on a daily basis, or necessarily that the opinion arms of NBC reflected his political priorities in quite the way that, for example, the Wall Street Journal's op-ed page is seen to be a pretty clear reflection of Rupert Murdoch's political priorities. But yeah, there was a moment in the election in 2000, the presidential in 2000, where allegedly he was pressuring the decision desk to call the election for Bush well before all the votes were counted. A few years before that, when the stock market was tanking, I think it was Tom Brokaw who was giving a pretty sober report on air. And Welch calls down and says, tell him to stop. You're killing the stocks, right? He didn't like the fact that GE's stock was going down as a result of this coverage. So he understood the power of the media full and well.
And then there were issues with I guess you would refer to as shady practices. Surprise, surprise. But they were pretty significant.
Can you be more specific?
SEC, towards the end, the SEC was looking into, was issuing fines. Yeah. The DOJ was issuing fines. On here with these accounting practices or?
Yeah, Welch faced multiple scandals throughout his career and survived them in a way that I think it's almost hard to imagine a CEO getting through that kind of a gauntlet today. But he survived for 20 years. There were defense scandals. There were collusion scandals in the diamond industry. More than once, GE under Welch was accused of defrauding the government knowingly. And all of these things you could see in the settlements, in the depositions, sort of the hallmarks of this absolute focus on increasing profits at all costs, coming right down from the top to the people who were actually committing the crimes. Now, after he left, the scandals continued to rack up. And on the accounting side, what happened was GE Capital, which we talked about earlier, became a vehicle, an instrument that the parent company could use to essentially manipulate its earnings, to smooth out its earnings. A few days, a few weeks before each quarter would end, it would look at the number that it was that analysts on Wall Street were expecting it to report, and it would make deals, fire people, take charges, find profits through GE Capital, whatever it needed to do to make those numbers look just right and keep the stock on this absolutely inexorable march upward. What happens several years later? The SEC catches on. Like, there are all sorts of shady accounting practices going on, and they settle for, I think, several billion dollars. Now, that settlement, important to note, pertained to periods, I think, from 2003 to 2005, so just after Welch retired. But in the settlement, they note that these practices, these same sort of things, look to have been well established, and the implication was clear. Though the SEC might not have had the goods, in part because regulation was much looser then. Financial reporting standards were much more lax in the 80s and 90s, but they were saying as clear as they could, this kind of stuff has been going on for a long time at GE.
So in the end, I mean, I know that you cite sort of like companies that are sort of changing, that are practicing business in a different way. Talk about that. But ultimately, aren't we really talking about we need to go back to a pre-Reagan version of regulation and of taxation? I mean, if you look at things like the stock buybacks, if you look about the changes in capital gains, which influence the way that people are compensated and allow for more stock compensation, that coincides with all of this ideology about shareholder value over all the other values that, you know, a stakeholder value, if you will, in terms of companies. We mentioned stock buybacks. Antitrust completely changed in the early 80s, late 70s, in terms of the way that the government would perceive, you know, that type of buying up and shedding of businesses and would be, you know, in a different regime, maybe one that we're starting to see today, just you wouldn't get away with it. Give me your sense of that.
I don't think we can turn back the clock. I think there are some values, some priorities, some of the ways that the government tried to actually regulate companies in the economy from earlier in the 20th century that can serve as useful models. But as you said a couple of times in this conversation, the world changed and the world's going to continue to change. So I think it'd be naive to think that we can sort of snap our fingers and go back to the golden age of capitalism, as it were, and think that companies are magically going to sort of stop prioritizing shareholders and strike this more equitable balance. I think it's just not going to be that simple. Instead, what I'm looking for are changes to incentive structures, changes to systems, changes to markets. You know, I think where we can start nudging companies, or if the government can ever get its act together, actually start regulating some of these changes and start essentially mandating or finding ways to incentivize companies to take better care of their workers, to stop doing everything at the expense of anything that might compromise shareholder value. And I point, as you say, in the book, to a few examples of companies that are starting to make steps in this right direction. But I don't think anything is going to happen quickly. And the way I think about it is it was a generational project that I describe in this book. It was decades and decades of work, from laying the intellectual groundwork from people like Friedman and Hayek to people like Welch actually taking the advantage of it and trying to put it into place, to decades of his proteges really driving this ethos down deep into our economy, to the point that a lot of people today don't even realize that things used to be a different way. Similarly, I think it's going to be a generational project. I think it's going to take decades of work to really create a more equitable economy. I wish it could happen faster. Anything that can nudge things along in the right direction, I'm all for it. But the reality of how big these problems are, the reality of how entrenched some of these systems are, suggests to me we are looking at decades of work ahead of us.
Do we have a cultural problem too, though? I contend that we're going to have much more regulation. We cannot rely on this. But is there also a cultural problem in terms of like the way that someone like Jack Welch has been sort of lionized and continues to be in some ways, right?
And didn't he break a record for how much money he got when he retired? What was that figure?
It was $417 million compensation back when he retired. Yeah, listen, this is where I start the book, Sam and Emma. This is like the very first lines of the book, The Man Who Broke Capitalism, are about our cultural problem and what the heck's going on in this society where we worship our CEOs, that it's captains of industry who are our cultural heroes, rather than, you know, people who are actually contributing something enduring, something truly valuable. You know, we have somehow romanticized the pursuit of profit as a good thing in its own right. So yeah, we've got deep cultural problems, and anything we can do to uproot that, I'm all favor for as well. But it starts with sort of recognizing that just because of someone like Jack Welch makes, you know, something close to $1 billion in his career simply for being a people manager who fired people and bought other companies, until we stop putting people like him up on pedestals, I think we've got a long way to go.
I just want to be clear, too. I mean, you're not suggesting we can't go back to the old regimes of regulation, right? I mean, we could theoretically close loopholes that allow for the financialization, you know, allow for companies to essentially become, you know, unregulated banks. I mean, such legislation has been proposed, certainly in the wake of the financial crisis. We are already seeing at least some reorientation to where we are on antitrust. The SEC could theoretically tomorrow say, you know what, stock buybacks, they're not a good idea. We used to call that stock manipulation, and we just redefined it so that's all possible. But is it also possible that we have just a problem with not bad capitalism, but capitalism in and of itself, that it's creating different categories of capitalism is in some way hiding the ball, right? I mean, Thomas Piketty argued that what we've referred to as the Great Compression, or you've called the Golden Age of Capitalism, was actually the anomaly. That was atypical, and certain things aligned, and that was a brief respite. But maybe there's a certain inevitability that we cannot rely on benign companies, but rather we need new structures and a new system for our economy so that this type of stuff doesn't happen.
Perhaps. Maybe I'll write my next book about that. I haven't done the full research, and I'm not going to sit here and pretend I know what the equitable replacement to capitalism as a whole structure is going to be. What I will say is that, listen, I think for all of its faults, capitalism, as it were, can also create a whole lot of good and wealth that has improved the standards of living for people in this country and beyond. And I think that, as part of the human project, is something we can't lose sight of. And so that's in no way an effort to excuse all of the sins of a system like capitalism. I just want to note that, human flourishing is also an important priority for myself, and I think is an important thing to think of in this conversation. So if we're going to uproot the system of capitalism, we better have a pretty good replacement waiting in the wings for it.
Indeed. David Gallis, climate reporter for The New York Times, author of The Man Who Broke Capitalism, How Jack Welch Gutted the Heartland and Crushed the Soul of Corporate America, and How to Undo His Legacy. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. We'll put a link to that book at majority.fm.
Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
All right, folks. I'm going to head into the fun half of the program, wherein you can call. Oh, but before we do, there was something that we wanted to talk about. I can't remember what it was.
And here. And here.
And who said capitalism's broken?
Yeah, exactly. Hello, ladies and gentlemen.
Look at that.
Here
look
we go.
Look at that. Hold on. Where do I go?
All right. I am modeling the latest addition to the Majority Report Mug Club, as we call it. We call it the Mug Club.
See?
we coined that?
Stupid.
Mug Club.
Coined it. Yeah, another one of our coinages.
Yeah.
Look at that.
Look at what's on the back of that. Pause it. This is the pause it mug.
Wow. All right, you go first.
Is that
yes, exactly. The
is pause that letter hack?
Huh? Yes, letter hack did the pause it figure there. So there it is. I don't know why you would want this at your kitchen table, an image of me yelling pause it, but people do.
It's just for you. It's not for anybody
exactly.
else.
Exactly. There's only one of the. Actually, there's only two of these. And
wow.
Right here, matching set.
So
and now, but Emma has something even more important to show. Hold
no,
on.
It's not. It's the same in importance. A Majority Report right here with Sam. With not Sam Cedar. This is the blue kind, and then there's also
left is best. Wait, show you can't see the whole. You got to see the front.
Okay, I was doing that
the
whole
time.
All right, here we go. Here's the front.
I can't see the EM part.
Jeez, I can't see the camera. Okay.
You got to put it up.
There you go.
There you go.
How's that?
There we go.
And pink. Then left is best.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's also a red version of it.
Yeah, it's
clay.
More like a maroon.
Wow.
Like
all
a
right.
terracotta.
Look at that. And that.
Yeah.
The blue on terracotta doesn't look bad.
Yeah, there you go.
Is that what you call a terracotta?
That's a little bit darker than I usually see terracotta, but
all right.
Terracotta-y.
Well... are those available at this point?
No.
No.
We're never going to
make those.
No,
those are just for us.
shop.majorityreportradio.com, ladies and gentlemen. Shop.majorityreportradio.com. Those are available right this moment. You can go buy it. In fact, pull it up on the web. Pull it up on
oh,
the,
my gosh, they're up there.
There we go.
Very reasonably priced, too, I will say.
Yeah, we're not taking much of a margin on this one. How many ounces does the posit mug hold? That's a good, at least 8.
Probably like 10.
Yeah.
Probably closer to 10.
It says, here we go, on the website.
God,
11
that.
Ounces.
Eat your heart out, Jack Welch. This is how you do... this is how you do capitalism right here, as you can see.
How are we financializing this? Can people pay in installments and we get them on the interest?
We give out micro loans for the pencils. And at 47% interest.
And you have to pay it back within a week?
Yeah, most of this stuff is rent to own. And so you get to wear the hat for like... You know, and you can rent it. Like it's all it is it's $5 for 36 months, and $5.
You'll never notice it.
You'll never notice it with a hat. You'll be wearing the hat all the time. Is that it? Do we have anything else on that page?
We can scroll down.
Yeah. Okay.
We got
oh my God! Look at this.
Ooh, I want that pullover.
A whole shirt, a whole store, department store.
Yeah, I didn't see that Majority Report pullover hoodie in red. I didn't know about that. Could you get one of those for Saul? That's all he wears now.
Hoodies.
All he wears.
Hey, they're cool.
Yeah,
yeah. That
cool.
was about me at that age too. I think it's he'll be doing that till he's about 32. I think.
But I'm saying like 95 degrees hoodie, 35 degrees hoodie, only, no sport, no winter coat, no summer thing, and. I mean,
his temperature regulation's probably excellent.
I think he might have absolutely no temperature regulation. Like it's like he doesn't seem to be aware of it. Anyways, folks, there it is. You can go, to our merch store.
The merch store.
Yeah, that too.
Dock your boat at the merch store.
But my shirts are a limited edition, so get them while you can, people.
Oh yeah, they're not going to be around forever.
Yeah,
I'm not going to. That encourages too much mutiny, and so have them around for just like just little drops.
Let the air out of the tire.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's like you give me the appearance of independence and
right,
takeover,
of course.
But then you snatch it away from me.
There you go.
Jack Welch would be proud.
Jack Welch would be very proud.
Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. 646-257-3920 is the number. We will see you.
Well, can I plug some stuff?
Oh, gosh.
Plug
sorry,
on Friday.
Sorry.
For patrons of
Left Brain. Why? Did I forget it on Friday, too?
We did a freebie. And so we didn't do
all
any
right,
of
okay.
things.
All right.
But speaking of who's coughing there, Emma Vigeland will be on Left Reckoning tomorrow night.
Hey!
Looking forward to her
yes.
making her first appearance. Also, for Left Reckoning patrons, we did the anti-nuclear argument with a listener of the show, at Show Us Your Work. So if people... We're starting to debate a little back and forth between the pro-nuke and the anti-nuke left on Left Reckoning, and we talked for about hour 15 minutes, maybe more than that, with Show Us Your Work about how some of the nuclear things might be overstated. I'm not one way or the other. I'm ambivalent about it. There's arguments from both sides I don't trust, so I like having people on to argue it, and it's probably not going to be the last time. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get that. I'm probably going to stream it out later this week.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who? What is up, everyone? Nomi Key.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this 7A?
Yes.
Me? You're safe?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go throw up.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So, what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$3 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
We call it satire. Sam goes, satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the weak being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.